Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. Lady Emma Hamilton is one of the most fascinating figures in 18th and 19th century British European history. She was born to illiterate parents, lived a life of rural poverty, rose to become the darling of the Prince Regent, sat at the very pinnacle of British society, married a knight of the realm, took part in great affairs of state, took part in the Game of Thrones, helped save the Neapolitan royal family, became the lover of Britain's greatest Admiral Nelson. Yet she died in poverty, addicted to drugs and alcohol in 1815 in Calais. Lady Emma Hamilton is a fascinating figure through which to look at the 18th century, both elite culture, but also what life was like for women, for normal people walking the streets, how hard it was, how fragile and the compromises, the decisions that people had to make to survive. I've got Joanna Lewis. She's a professor in the Department of History at the London School of Economics. She's actually a specialist in modern Africa and the European imperial carve-up of Africa. But she's agreed to talk to me about Lady Emma Hamilton. I'll tell you why. Because she discovered that she is a descendant of Emma and Nelson. Just imagine for a second having the blood of Nelson and Emma Hamilton in your veins. I mean, unbelievable. It's the dream right there. And so Joanna has come on to tell us all about her illustrious forebear, the very misunderstood but fascinating Emma Hamilton. Enjoy.
T-10.
Atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima.
God save the king.
No black-white unity till there is first some black unity.
Never to go to war with one another again.
And liftoff, and the shuttle has cleared the tower.
Joanna, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Just tell the audience, at her peak, how famous was Lady Emma Hamilton?
Well, if you think of Kim Kardashian crashing the internet, then you've got a little bit of a taste of how famous she was in Britain, in Europe. You know, she had a face that everybody knew about. So she was probably, at her peak, one of the most well-known women in the Western world.
So it didn't begin like that. What do we know about her early life?
Oh my goodness. Well, her early life, it could not have been more humble and more difficult. She was born Amy Lyon on the 26th of April, 1765. And the small village of Ness, where she was born in Cheshire, which is 12 miles from Liverpool, it was described in the 1850s as, and I quote, primitive. So that means minus hovels. One in three children died in infancy. And things got worse when her father, who was a blacksmith, died when she was just a few months old. So her mother had to take her young daughter and move to Flintshire in North Wales, where the grandmother helped bring her up. But again, poverty was awful. Shortages of food. It was, in effect, a country slum. Mud brick walls, rags over the window. And the grandmother was the only breadwinner, and she would sell coal at the side of the road. So it was grim.
She sounds like she was lucky to survive childhood.
Absolutely. Very, very lucky. She was the daughter of illiterate parents. And if she did go to school, I don't think it would have been very much or for very long, because at the age of 12, she was put into domestic service for a surgeon and his family in Chester. And so that would have been her lot, emptying commodes and chamber pots and just basically all day keeping the rooms free from soot from the low quality coal. And we know that she didn't have a very good education, but she crucially understood the impact of that, because at 19, she lamented, "If only I'd had an education, what a great woman I might have become."
What's attested about her? Did anyone leave an account of her in her teenage years?
We do have some reports from those who employed her. I mean, she was not very good at being a servant. She dared to fail, as one biographer has said. She wasn't very good at all those jobs, but she was already growing up to be very strong, very beautiful. And I think crucially, we often underestimate, you know, the role perhaps of women in her life and her mother. Her mother had been very strategic, and she had gone up to the local big house and got scraps of food. She got friendly with the butler, make of that what you want. And so Emma had been very well fed. So she never lacked nutrition. So she was strong. She was beautiful.
Is this a world in which actually your beauty, your kind of physicality was very dependent on childhood nutrition and obviously your health?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely bang on there. And because she's known later for this luxurious thick mane, this wonderful translucent skin, you know, perfect teeth. I think her mother, you know, was really important in how she made sure that Emma had lots of protein, had lots of fresh vegetables. And I think she was really loved by her mother and her grandmother. She was really nurtured. However, of course, you know, the wife, a mistress in a house, when she's got a servant like this, remember, she's 12, 13 at this time when she's working in these houses, very, very vulnerable. But we know that one mistress described her as simply a fat Welsh girl, just up from the country, capable of nothing but scrubbing and scouring with no desire to learn anything. Ouch.
What's the turning point? Did she get taken to London or something? How does she...
The big turning point, I think, is just, you know, her chutzpah, her bravery. So she gets sacked, obviously, from this gig. And she makes the big decision, aged just 13. You know, for those of us who know 13-year-olds, oh my God, it's so young. She travels to London, takes her 5 days, manages to avoid capture, sexual assault, and, you know, being immediately pimped. And then at a inn at Trafalgar Square, she gets chosen to be a maid for a family there. And so, again, we see her working in service, a very dangerous occupation for a young woman. But the turning point again here is that she goes to Covent Garden. She runs off in the evening with a fellow maid, and they go and watch the actresses there, and they are enthralled, you know, the makeup, the beauty, the treading of the boards. And so guess what? She gets sacked again, and she's turned out. Yeah, it's here where things could have gone very, very badly, and they really did for a while, because although she works for a while as a maid to one of the famous actresses, that job folds and she's out on the streets. At one point, she's seen selling fruit and veg in a barrel wearing wooden shoes. And we also know, as she sort of admitted herself, that she has to turn to prostitution. She describes herself later on as, "Necessity forced me to fall from virtue, but my sense of virtue was never overcome."
It's an amazing turn of phrase there.
Yeah.
How then does she begin climbing the pretty hostile social ladder of Georgian England?
Whoa. I mean, she is lucky. Because, you know, it's a very seedy world here with a lot of predatory males. And the first sort of rung up the seedy ladder, if you like, towards some kind of security is that a man, a quack, you know, called Dr. Graham, sets up this temple of good health, and he sets her up on stage as this goddess of good health. And so men will pay money to watch her. So she's sort of the equivalent of Georgian Viagra, I think. She's this sensuous young girl with long hair. She's in diaphanous clothes. And so she becomes this figure of health, going back to her beauty and her voluptuousness. She's the picture of youthful good health. And she also then comes to the notice of a local female brothel owner. In exchange for, in effect, becoming her prisoner, she gets access to the best clothes, you know, makeup done, hair done, and also to her very, very wealthy clients. Again, this is a game changer.
So that's interesting. Do we know how he came across her and selected her?
I think she'd been on the street, and we go back to, you know, what is a fundamental feature of her that is important to recognise, and that is just her beauty, her just natural beauty and good looks. And as you said earlier, you know, this is a time of ill health. A lot of people don't make it. A lot of people are scarred or pockmarked. But she was literally in rude health, and she's on the streets, and she gets noticed, first of all, by this so-called, you know, doctor of good health. It's actually probably a bit pervy what he does. But anyway, it brought her then to the attention, her beauty, of this high-class pimp. She knows that that Emma is somebody that her clients are going to really appreciate.
At this point, she's how old?
She's probably, at this point, 15, 14, 15.
God, it's amazing. Astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah. How many didn't make it?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. We're here sort of celebrating her life and talking about her and all of her peers, all of the people that she would have been serving alongside, if that's the right verb, would have lived very different lives, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And her beauty draws her to the attention of Sir Harry Featherstone Hoare, who, villain of the piece, possibly. Let's see what we make of him. He, in effect, bought her from the madame for his Sussex estate as a piece of beautiful adornment.
And straight out of Thomas Hardy, this, isn't it? It's absolutely extraordinary.
It is. And he had these legendary sort of parties, of stag parties, and it's alleged she danced naked on the table for him. She became his mistress because he was enchanted. You know, her beauty was magnetic, and there was nobody quite, you know, her equivalent. So it did go well in some ways for her because, as we've said, she wanted to learn. So it's here that she learns for the first time to read and write. She also learns how to horse ride, which she loves, and she starts to learn sort of social graces. And lucky for her, he preferred hunting and shooting. So that gave her, you know, a little time away from him. But disaster. She becomes pregnant. And what does Sir Harry do? Well, he turfs her out. And she has to return to her family home of Howarden in North Wales, where she gives birth to a little girl in 1782. Her mother and grandmother, of course, don't turn her out. So this is important. And she's destitute at 16, however, an ex-prostitute, a married woman with a baby. Again, she's very clever. She's very strategic. She doesn't give up. And she can now write. So she writes a letter to one of Sir Harry's friends who she's bonded with when she was there, the Honourable Charles Greville. Now, Greville is the second son of the Earl of Warwick. And he agrees to help her. But she must do what he says. She must give up the baby. And he puts her in a small house in Edgware Road. She becomes his property. And he's a bit of a control freak. He controls what she does, how she speaks, what she wore. Also, there's more education going on here. So it's a bit creepy. We don't really know the degree of perhaps threat and coercion involved, but it was like Operation Mistress for him.
And is this the point at which we might recognise Lady Emma in her own life? Because she was painted in a series of extraordinarily beautiful paintings by George Romney. Did Greville make that connection?
Absolutely. After 3 years, he was quite happy with his work, if you like. And so he starts to introduce her to some of his artistic and more bohemian friends. And it's in 1782 that this life-changing moment happens when she meets George Romney. Now, he's also a man of a certain age for whom a teenage beauty, you know, is rather lovely to behold. But he is Britain's, you know, best portrait painter at this time. And he has a love of Italian Renaissance, classical antiquity, And as you say, he paints her in all these different poses. I mean, he's almost got OCD towards her. So she is this international celebrity now because of the way in which he's presented her in his artwork that gets, you know, reproduced in postcard form, in print form, Sybil, Cassandra, Titania, all these classical figures where she is showing emotion, learning those actress skills that she had observed. She puts them into practice. And all these classical figures now she is sort of breathing new life into. And he is simply enchanted with her beauty and he paints her again and again and again. But it's important to also recognise that there were women painters at the time, for example, Elizabeth Vigée, who also painted her and circulated her portrait around Europe. So, you know, Emma had presence as well in Europe, not just in Britain.
You're listening to Dan Snow's History. We're talking about Lady Emma Hamilton, Nelson's lover, and much else besides. More after this.
Why were medieval priests so worried that women were going to seduce men with fish that they'd kept in their pants? Who was the first gay activist? And what on earth does the expression sneezing in the cabbage mean? I'll tell you, it's not a cookery technique, that's for sure. Join me, Kate Lister, on Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal in society, a podcast where we will be bedhopping throughout time and civilization to bring you the quirkiest and kinkiest stories from history. What more could you possibly want? Listen to Betwixt the Sheets today, wherever it is that you get your podcasts. A podcast by History Hit.
Join us this month on Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Matt Lewis.
And I'm Eleanor Yonaga. This April, dive into our special mini-series.
With the help of leading experts, we're tracing the foundations of England by exploring the country's most powerful Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
We'll be looking at Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex, as well as the rulers and their councils who helped shape a nation.
Make sure to get every episode by listening and following Gone Medieval from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you're using messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes. And you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage, add unlimited photos and videos, and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's A-U-R-A frames.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. So she's becoming a European celebrity. Remarkable. What does Greville, this control, not great for the controlling, weird lover, if that's the right word?
You're not wrong there. Greville was actually now getting rather worried because, you know, she's got all these aristocratic figures at her feet. She's an international celebrity. So he's getting a bit worried because not only has he got massively in debt, but he's now under pressure to get married. And it's definitely not going to be to Emma. In effect, he's very conniving and he arranges for her to marry his uncle, Sir William Hamilton. Sir William Hamilton is recently widowed. He's aged 60, Emma is 26 at this point. And he says to Emma, look, you know, I want you to go and stay with Sir William. He is in Naples. I think you should just spend some time there, take some time out. Of course, it's permanent as far as Granville is concerned. And Emma is devastated. She's absolutely in love with Granville. And also Romney is absolutely devastated as well. So she gets sent off to stay with him. And for Sir William, it is, of course, love at first sight. He's been described as an amiable voluptuary. Well, I had to look up that word. I thought it was something to do with man boobs. Actually, it's somebody who's devoted to luxury and sensual pleasure, sort of high living. So his classical taste, he had a great collection of art, and you know, she was his ideal and a female beauty. And it's here that she develops these poses, which she goes on stage called the Attitudes. I don't know if you've heard about those.
Yes, the Attitudes. I went to an exhibition once and I suddenly realised that I was basically Lady Emma Hamilton, because she just took sort of, she would act, but in sort of mute, just take these heroic poses on the stage, or these sort of romantic poses. And I suddenly realised I've made a whole TV career doing that, Joanna. In fact, you saw me on the stage the other day. You probably can agree with this, but I realised I've got more in common with Lady Emma than I thought.
Well, I didn't see you wearing a diaphanous toga that was see-through. It's not come to that yet, and I hope it won't. But she would be statuesque. It was called tableau vivants, where she would pose as these great classical figures, you know, juju her hair, maybe alter her drapes, you know, risque, of course. I mean, you know, it's not everybody who's doing this and getting away with it. But, you know, Sir William gave her respectability, and as His Majesty's envoy in the court of Naples, you know, he gave her social standing and an opportunity to become friends with Queen Caroline of Naples and Sicily. And he also gives Emma a chance to learn and develop her intellect. At this point, she's fluent in Italian and French, but she's also very fun and frivolous. You know, I'm sure she can, you know, tell a good joke. She likes to have a laugh. So again, this is hugely defining.
And in the 18th century, obviously we imagine a very stratified world, but there are examples through acting, through this kind of thing, of women fighting their way into the aristocracy. Like, it's not, although I'm sure it would have raised eyebrows, that it's not, she's not super unique, that there was precedence for this kind of mobility.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's important to remember that. However, it was quite bounded. You know, if she'd stayed respectable, married to Sir William, but the problem for her and her reputation with regard to wider society is that she always goes one step further, because I think, of course I would, you know, because of her natural ability. And here, for example, then, classic example, the big, big moment, is that she is able to perform a role of intelligence gathering, and she acts as a diplomat. I mean, you would know more about this than me, but it's the time of the French Revolution. It's a time of great upheaval. And I always thought, you know, Italy, surely, you know, this is not, you know, Naples, a bit of a backwater. But actually, it becomes very important and very strategic. So again, she is going above her station. And also, we know that she's behaving then quite badly.
Well, in what respect is she behaving badly? I think we might say she's behaving, having a rather good time.
She's having a very, very good time, and she is having such a great time because the hero of the moment, the hero of the hour, Rear Admiral Horatio Nelson, rolls into town, but, you know, rolls into port. And this is really such an extraordinary moment. It's a high point in many ways, you know, of her life, meeting him. But also, tragically, it is the beginning of the end as well. It's one of those, you know, paradoxical, tragic encounters. And she becomes his mistress.
It was pretty electrifying. Yeah. They were into each other.
I've got chills, they're multiplying. Yeah, just thinking about it. Absolutely. You know, he was quite battered and bruised, wasn't he, at this time? When he came back from the Battle of the Nile and limped into the port of Naples, he was really unwell. He had lost an arm, his eyesight was fading, he was, you know, very thin. And she nursed him back to health. You know, she literally scooped him up in her arms, which, you know, were quite substantial by this time. She became the love of his life, and she became mistress to the greatest military hero of the age. You know, could she get any more famous? Hashtag infamous.
Yeah. There's then some fairly complicated politics that goes on in Naples. I mean, she was very close to the royal family, wasn't she? She got Nelson to behave pretty badly, and way overstepping his, well, I guess his orders, his sort of permissions from the British government, and he intervenes in kind of Neapolitan politics and the sort of revolution there and stuff, partly down to her influence over him.
Yes, I mean, that makes sense. You know, she had really got into his good books by allegedly, through Queen Caroline, arranging food to go to the fleet when it had just defeated the French. They were very short of supplies. Queen Caroline had, you know, given her a platform, had given her respectability, had accepted her at court. So, you know, she kind of owed her. So, yeah, she did work through Nelson. And that's, you know, quite a controversial period of his life. And I think, you know, as a result, he's recalled home. Possibly that was the reason why.
And does she go with him?
Absolutely. The three of them go back home together, Sir William.
Well, including her husband.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he also loved her. And he also, you know, loved Nelson. As you know, Nelson inspired, you know, such adoration in men, you know, and women. He was a total hero. So they go back together, and Nelson writes, "She is one of the very best women in this world. She is an honour to her sex. Her kindness is more than I can express." And he says, I am bringing home a most faithful, honourable heart. So I think it's good to just reflect on her character at this point. He hadn't just fallen for a floozy, you know, who wore see-through clothing when she struck a pose, this, you know, voluptuous image of good health when, you know, he was broken, no upper teeth, prematurely aged. I think there was a genuine appreciation of her kindness and generosity, which, you know, we will see again coming through later on.
So the husband doesn't mind that much. Does he know about the affair, or does he just not really, is it ignorant, or does he not really care? He's too busy with his Pompeii relics.
Yeah, the equivalent of a sort of garden shed he had, I'm sure, in terms of his interest. But don't forget, he was quite old at this point, and they managed to keep certain things from him, because as they come back, it's clear that Emma is now pregnant Nelson's child. You know, Sir William, I think, just puts up with it. I mean, he's lampooned in the press, you know, for being this ridiculous figure that is allowing this to go on. But his health is also failing. And when the three of them set up house together in London, Emma remains, of course, devoted to him, nurses him during his illness. And, you know, he dies in her arms with Nelson there as well. So, yeah, it's ménage à trois, quite an interesting relationship. But Nelson wasn't going to give her up. She wasn't going to give him up. So it just carried on.
Nelson's wife also lived nearby, we should say, and he gave her up.
Yes.
At this point, as they say. So Lady Emma is now a widow, but Nelson is not, of course. So yeah, Nelson's separated, but he can't marry her.
Absolutely. His wife doesn't want to let him go. And of course, although they don't have children, he has lots of extended family. And, you know, he comes under some criticism. I think the ambassador's wife of Naples described how he was led around by Lady Hamilton like a keeper with a bear. And she is seen as vulgar and uncouth. She still has a regional accent, and there are all these bawdy tales. But they live openly together in Piccadilly, in the house where Horatio is born. Eventually, of course, the wheels start to come off. And what is so awful for Emma, because she relies on Nelson so much. I mean, she's massively in love with him, but he gives her this, you know, respectability. They go out together. They go touring the country. They are feted wherever they go. But, you know, that costs money. And so she's living the lifestyle, dishing out the cash, trying to be sort of more generous and more opulent than their social equivalent, trying to prove, you know, herself. And she's getting more and more in debt. And then what's awful for her is that in 1803, Nelson gets called back to sea.
So they've got a daughter. He's going to sea to command the Mediterranean fleet. War's broken out again. There was a brief period of peace, but war's broken out again. And is that a big problem for her if he's not around?
Absolutely. She's incredibly vulnerable. So she's putting on more weight. Her anxiety is escalating that she's never going to see him again. She's turning to gambling. She's turning to drink. Yes, she's still got that beautiful countenance, but her looks and her health are fading. We know that she is anxious about him. She writes to him, thinking that she's never going to see him again, and says, "You are the dearest husband of my heart. You are all in this world to your dear Emma." And again, in the letters, we see an equivalent tenderness, you know, for him. She has this premonition that she will never, ever see him again. And of course, she doesn't, because we know that the Battle of Trafalgar, he gets mortally wounded. And when she's told about this, she cannot speak. She cannot cry for 10 hours. And then she is incapacitated with grief, not just for days, not just for weeks, but for months.
Nelson had requested that the state look after her in the event of his death, just for the Battle of Trafalgar. He'd written quite a lot, really. He's worrying about her. The state did not look after her at all. Do you think she knew that his death meant ruin for her?
I think possibly it was more about literally being in love, infatuation, adoration. But I'm sure there is a general sense absolutely of vulnerability. The extent of her financial vulnerability needn't have been so great. For example, Sir William's estate, Grenville, if you remember, who engineered the marriage with Sir William Hamilton, he didn't provide, you know, enough for her. He didn't settle her debts. He did not also ensure that a generous pension was transferred to her. Sir William Hamilton never mentioned in dispatches back to the Foreign Office of just how much work Emma had done behind the scenes diplomatically with regard to the fleet and nursing Nelson, you know, back to health. So she never had a pension in her own right. But I think on the other side of that, of course, is her spending. She was desperate to keep Nelson's family, you know, in her favour. She was paying for school fees. She was paying for parties, for holidays. She couldn't let go of the house, the large house that her and Nelson had. So it's really, really sad that I think partly because of the sexism of the time and the laws and also the prejudice that she wasn't seen as a woman who should be taken care of, and financial provision was not as it should have been.
She was excluded from his enormous funeral. The establishment really start to try and elbow her out of the scene, don't they?
Absolutely. It really is the beginning of the end. Within 3 years of his death, she'd become £15,000 in debt, which was a hell of a lot of money. But she's also getting scammed. His family are still willing to accept money from her. She's far too generous to relatives and to family. And, you know, of course, she's used to the high life and, you know, her spending is, you know, even more than mine. It's really, really awful, because between 1811 and 1812, she's in a debtor's prison, an open prison, because of the fact that she can't pay her creditors. And in July 1814, she flees from London to get away from her creditors, and she flees to Calais. She just has £50 in her purse. She's brokenhearted, beaten down by the way society has, you know, turned away from her, crippled by stomach pains, drinking heavily. She's addicted to laudanum. She still has the loyalty of her old housekeeper and some of her maids, and her daughter Horatia is still with her. But sadly, illness overtook her. And at the age of 49, she died over a couple of days, you know, very horrible, painful death of organ failure. This is on the 15th of January, 1815. She has just £10 in her pocket, a couple of pawn receipts and clothes that she was wearing. That's all she had.
Yeah, it's very sad. She sold any mementos she had of Nelson, didn't she, to try and get by her and her daughter.
Yes, she was always mindful of what would happen to Horatia. She was also criticised in the press for publishing letters. So, yeah, she was seen as somebody who had, you know, really brought Nelson down, that she had paraded in his glory. One nasty comment as well from the time is that she had lowered the name of the English matron to that of a Parisian fisherwoman. Harsh.
These powerful men picked her up and dropped her as they pleased. You know, the Prince Regent was obsessed with the future George IV at times and would go and dine at Merton, and then he'd refuse to sort of answer her letters at other times. I mean, it must have been very, I think we might say, gaslighting these days, you know, to have these powerful men obsessed with you and declare their undying love and then just completely ignore you a year or two later. It must have been so difficult.
Yeah, that's a really good way of pushing it, actually. I hadn't thought of that. And I think that really underscores, I think, the decline, really the illness, the stomach pains. You know, we would call it trauma now. But as you say, the rise and fall, to live with such precariousness and also to have fallen in love so deeply and madly, and then to have had the trauma of that death, you know, knowing that he died in the way that he did. So I suspect that, you know, the drinking, the excess, the desire for affection from, you know, his family, it was all part of, you know, what we might see as a psychological impact, you know, of those kinds of horrible experiences.
What happened to her daughter? Their daughter?
Well, her daughter could never acknowledge publicly that she was the offspring of Lord Nelson and Lady Emma Hamilton. Of course, as is the case, you know, when you're an offspring of such chaos and such excess and such drama, she went completely the other way. And Horatia did not look like her mother. She looked very much like her father. There is this extraordinary photograph of her not long before, I think, she eventually passed away in the 1860s, because photography was taking off there. And she is a spitting image, really, of her father. And she married a vicar, the Reverend Philip Ward, and they went on to have 9 children.
Are you descended from one of those children?
My father and his uncles always told the story when we were growing up that we were descended. And I must say, whenever he told that story, my mother and my various aunts would roll their eyes and say, oh, for goodness sake, not this old story again. But to their credit, when they all retired, my Uncle Brian led the charge and he went to the archives, you know, births, marriages, death. He plotted that family tree and it looks like it's true. And of course, they were delighted. They focused on the Nelson side naturally. And they would have these Nelson day outs where they'd wear the Nelson insignia ties and they'd go and see HMS Victory and go to various pubs where Nelson and Lady Emma Hamilton had stayed. So it was a very important part of my childhood, actually. And I love them for it because it gave me this love of history as well as a scepticism.
Are we in a place now where, I mean, she was despised through the Victorian period and the sort of very proper male historians writing about her. Are we in a place now where we can view her life far more even-handedly?
I would absolutely say so. There's been a lot of work to rehabilitate the sort of sexism, that lens of, you know, misogyny that she was subjected to. And as you mentioned earlier, there was this marvellous exhibition of portraits of her at the National Maritime Museum a few years ago, and that focused on seduction and celebrity. However, I think it's also important not to underestimate the world in which she lived with regard to what was done to women, the withholding of education, how she was subject to very coercive male control. But it was her character as well as her beauty that managed to rescue her from, you know, an otherwise very dire situation. And I think we're also in a position to acknowledge the role of those important female friendships, the importance of the love of her mother and her grandmother, and the female friendships that she forged, and the loyalty of women that she was able to engineer.
It's one of the most remarkable lives, actually, of recent British history. Thank you so much, Joanna Lewis, for coming on and talking about it.
My pleasure. It's been absolutely wonderful to speak about her. Thank you so much.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe as a special gift. You can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.